KPCW News Time now, 8:12. Good morning. Well, the Summit County Council making frequent trips to the state capitol to participate in this year's legislative session. Joining me now in the studio with a report on some of the bills that they're keeping their eyes on, I have Councilmember Glenn Wright. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Leslie.
Well, let's see. Councilmember Kim Carson gave a legislative report at Wednesday's meeting, so let's start there. House Bill 280 from Representative Albrecht saying that counties between the 4th to 6th class would be allowed to take their transient room tax funds to use for EMS or law enforcement infrastructure because these agencies are impacted by tourism. Does Summit County even meet that allowance?
We don't necessarily need it. It would be nice. We tried to get our name, our third class counties added to that, but we didn't think it was worth risking the chance of the 4th through 6th class. So we supported the bill as it was. We sent out some inquiries, can you include us? But they said, if we do that, it may fail. So we, in solidarity to our smaller counties, we said, go ahead, we'll support this.
Okay. But are you saying we don't need the money?
Oh, we always need the money. But let's face it, they need it worse. The southern Utah counties are really hurting for EMS funds.
Okay. And why so tight? I mean, that they're holding on to those transient room tax funds. I mean, again, when we have a Republican-dominated legislature that says they want small government, that they want to put, the power, closest to the people. I mean, this is just always goes against that. And one more example.
A couple of things. Opposition from the actual resort industry. They don't particularly like the transient room tax, and the legislature likes to micromanage. It's kind of inherent in their way of doing business.
All right, let's see. House Bill 305, that creates some changes in how referendums can be brought up. Is this, again, making it more difficult for the public to overturn unfavorable government decisions?
I think it clarifies the procedures a little bit better. I don't think it makes it either more difficult or easier.
Okay, so what's the county's thought on that?
305, huh? That's not what I have here for 305. But
okay.
I have impact fees for House 305. But at any rate, we didn't have any problem with that particular concept.
Okay. House Bill 273, this is from Val Peterson, affects how local governments who have lost a development lawsuit, right now they may be called on to pay attorney fees for the other side. The new bill says that if a land use decision that got them sued and it was contrary to the advice of the state's land use ombudsman, they would have to pay compensatory damages.
Yeah, we are absolutely opposed to that one. In the UAC conference yesterday, we had unanimous approval, joint opposition to that particular bill. That opens up a gigantic can of worms and makes, counties, potentially several times responsible for those types of suits.
And then gives a lot more power to ombudsman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Essentially, you create a situation where you have competing legal opinions. And we see that all the time. Every time we have an appeal, we have two legal opinions, and we have to choose one. And then the ombudsman is one, and frequently they have different opinions. So it really, you're rolling the dice on that one, and it could result in very large losses to counties and cities.
Any idea how many lawsuits, land use lawsuits, we're still involved in? I know that this was a huge issue for former manager Bob Jasper. I mean, that was kind of what he wanted to kind of clean the county's legal slate.
I do not know that number, but I don't think we have very many left, if any.
Okay. Let's see, House Bill 265, this is a data collection reporting requirement.
Yeah, this one's kind of ridiculous. It would really put a burden on city and county staffs all over the state, and all of this information is actually still available. All this does is it collects it in one place so somebody who wants to search the database can do so more easily. So essentially we're doing work for people who want to do government database research. And the estimate in Summit County would take us three FTEs to fulfill the requirements for that particular bill. And the reality is all the information is there. If somebody wants it, if they want to get a grandma request, the procedures are there for it.
Okay, so this would be redundant and expensive, huh?
Both.
Let's see, House Bill 166, something about watershed councils?
Yes, we're still getting clarity on that, exactly what that's all about. We wanted to get some clarity. UAC also wants to get some clarity on that. It's coming from the governor's office, and they have a state watershed council. Exactly what they want to do on a local basis, we're not sure. Summit County already has representatives on Weber Basin and Provo River conservation districts. So we're not sure what they really want.
Okay. House Bill 271 would preempt firearm regulations imposed by local governments. So what's that about?
Well, that actually has an interesting twist. We, as UAC, we voted to support that yesterday. The feeling was it was originally aimed at Salt Lake County when Mayor Wilson required the gun shows at the Southtown Expo Center to do background checks on everybody. Reality is it doesn't, because that is purely a contract. Yeah, Salt Lake County owns the building, and it's a contract that they have the ability to enforce. So they didn't really propose any additional, you know, countywide ordinances. At the same time, though, Uinta County is in the process of passing resolutions to be a Second Amendment supporter zone that would resist any future gun rights restrictions. And this would actually bring the regulation of firearms at the state level and not allow local governments to be more restrictive. Now, from my standpoint, if we had the ability to make them more restrictive in Summit County, I would be in favor of that. But I know that if we did, we would immediately get slapped down by the legislature. So the reality is this probably is a reasonable bill. And surprisingly enough, or maybe not surprisingly enough, all of UAC, including a lot of the conservative counties, supported it.
Okay. House Bill 138, county would have to give notice to the state if they acquired Greenbelt property as open space. So if this had been in effect last year, that would have impacted the Gilmore purchase?
Yeah, we're not happy about that one. And, we're in opposition to that one. There is some question as to what the applicability would be. One of the questions we discussed at the council actually was, well, when does this notice occur? If the notice occurred, 5 minutes before closing, no big deal. But if you're required to make that notice when you start negotiations on a property, that would open up a gigantic can of worms on essentially negotiations, because then they would be public, and we might not get the best deal we could for the county.
What's the intent of this bill, though? I mean, what's the concern?
I think it's coming from UDOT. My understanding is it's coming from UDOT, and they just want to be they want to know when this is happening.
And why do they need to know? I'm trying to figure, kind of get my mind around
I'm
it.
I'm not sure. As I said before, frequently the legislature likes to micromanage what counties do, and I think this is one of those efforts.
Okay. I mean, I can understand near open space, near roadways, because they might be interested in it themselves.
And potentially they might have future plans for a road. If you ever get UDOT in here for an interview, be sure to ask them that, because we don't have a clear answer from them on why they're interested in that.
Okay. You had also mentioned Wednesday that there are a couple of proposals that you've heard about that haven't been put forward yet as a numbered bill.
Yeah. One of them that's in drafting is a protection for senior fraud. A legislator, and I can't remember his name now, from Davis County had a constituent who was scammed to the over $100,000 on telephone fraud to a senior. They just reeled this person in and kept getting wire transfers into external accounts. And we see that in the Sheriff's Watch Log all the time, that we have constant attempts at telephone fraud in the county. What this would do, and we haven't seen the final language yet, but what I listened to the legislator who's proposing it, it would force banks to take a little more notice of unusual transactions, particularly from senior citizens, so that, say, most people don't do large wire transfers. It would have to go through a bank officer rather than just a teller. And if you placed on the account other names that needed to be notified, not that they had to give permission, but just notified, they could call family and say, Grandma, what's happening here?
Yeah. Let's see. A second bill has to do with the funding for Alzheimer's treatment. What's that about?
That would be in the appropriations area. And the Alzheimer's Association managed to get something like $2.4 billion in federal appropriations for research. If we had some seed money, for instance, at the University of Utah, where they have a neurology research clinic, that might bring in some federal research dollars for research into treating Alzheimer's.
Okay. So where's the council directing its lobbyists to spend time on?
On those particular bills plus a few others that we talked about all of these at UAC also, and the interesting thing is that Summit County and UAC are in complete agreement on opposition and support for most of these bills. Supporting bills SB 95 that consolidates economic development funds. Big one, HB 38 that extends Medicaid coverage to individuals 30 days before they get out of the jail so that our people that are on probation can immediately have Medicaid coverage for treatment when they get out. That's a really important bill. Also, HB 32, again, a mental health bill, funds additional mobile crisis units. A new one that came out yesterday we talked about, HB 54, will allow heavy timber construction in Utah. It's a practice that's been already in place in Oregon for a couple of years and will allow our forests to be a source of building materials. If you go above three stories now, you're typically using concrete and steel, whereas heavy timber construction can do the same thing in the new building codes, up to perhaps as much as 16 stories. And if we start using beetle kill in laminated construction in heavy timber construction, we would actually be sequestering that carbon in a building for a long periods of time and reducing the carbon footprint on used for to make carbon concrete and steel. So those are the supported ones. I just mentioned one other one that's an opposition. It's kind of a funny bill. We all call it the pig bill. And Smithfield Industries wants to create some massive pig farms in Beaver and Millard County, and they were fighting the zoning requirements down there and losing, and they... They're proposing a bill to override county ordinances, which, aside from being a windfall for a private company, it would set the precedent that the state could override county ordinances and city building development ordinances all over the state. So there is universal opposition to this. Another example of how money affects the legislature and how they like to micromanage local conditions.
Okay. Glenn, I need to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning. That's Summit County Council Member Glenn Wright with that legislative update. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. And joining me now in the studio, Park City Mayor Andy Bierman with some of the takeaways from that first day of the Visioning Retreat. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. That's a good recap.
You will continue then to deep dive into community visioning today. The public welcome to sit in.
Oh, absolutely. We'd love to have some more public there. Where it gets interesting today is going to be at 10:30. We're going to have a discussion about sustainable tourism, what that means and what that might look like as a strategic pillar in our community, and also about arts, culture, and local economy.
Okay. Of those six pillars that we've talked about, I mean, have we prioritized those pillars?
It's really hard. You know, that would be like prioritizing our core values. They're all things that are critical, and you can't extricate them from each other. They're all tied together in many ways. So, practically speaking, council asked for staff to come back with some discussions on transportation first, how we might accelerate that. That's something I think we're teed up for the first discussion, and we'll see that in March. So that'll be the first thing we attack. That doesn't necessarily mean that's our most urgent priority, but it is a priority.
Yeah. And someone noted that the city's working on many of these issues already, so you're not starting from scratch. I mean, is it easier to start anew as opposed to?
No, I was actually really happy as we went through this community visioning process to see that there wasn't anything major we were missing or any crazy left turns, that the community's really come back and reaffirmed our core values and our critical priorities and say they still want us really focused on those. The biggest feedback we got is it's about velocity. They want us to accelerate. They don't feel like they like where we're going as a local government, but they want us to do more quicker.
And I, you know, kind of just reading through some of the notes that our reporter took, I was a little confused by that. I mean, what embracing bold change means? I mean, is it that people want bold action to do something different, or are we talking about embracing bold action not to change?
That's a great question. A little bit of both, I think, depending on your perspective. Council actually had that debate whether we should be saying embracing bold action. I think that is largely, we want to protect many of the things that make us special, our sense of community, our small town, our character as a community, our natural environment. So we don't necessarily want to change those things, but I think we're going to have to take action, which might require some personal changes and a little bit of changes how we do things to get us there. So it's going to be a mix to protect what matters most to us. We will have to change how we do things. That doesn't mean we're going to fundamentally change the town.
Well, but you were the one that kind of mentioned just the split in the community. I mean, keeping the small town feeling, or, I mean, do we now take bold action to create more of the urban principles and densify? Because that's what we're looking at.
Max pointed out he thinks it's somewhat generational. I'll agree with that, although I don't think it's a clean cut. I think there is a part of our community that thinks that we're growing at a pace. We need to look at more urban principles. There's definitely a part of our community that really cherishes that small town feel and doesn't want to mess with it. My two cents is that we're probably going to have to evolve to a more mature model, which you'll see maybe in Europe in some of their resort towns, which they haven't been at this 50 years, they've been at 500 years, and they've found ways to bring in some urban principles but still maintain that small town feel. And that's really going to be the tightrope we're going to have to walk.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting, though. I mean, I was 20 here in Park City at one time, and I'm not sure that my just because I'm older that my priorities have changed. I mean, just to say that the millennials think differently. Really?
I wasn't the one that suggested that, yeah. Although I do see I see a trend that it tends to be those that are newer in town and looking to get established would like to see more opportunities, and usually faster growth creates more opportunities. Density in housing creates more affordable housing typically and more opportunities. So it tends to be the younger generations more attracted to that. Like I said, I don't see it as a clean cut. There's just a little bit trends there.
So the retreat conversations will lead to the development of a strategic plan. What kind of consensus did the council start moving toward yesterday then on that?
Oh, I'd say it's early to have a consensus on this. The strategic pillars, the one thing we did which was significant is I think we're going to strike regional synergy as a strategic pillar, because it's more of a lens or a tool we will use as opposed to a specific action. You don't go out to create regional synergy per se. It's something we want to utilize when we talk about transportation and housing. We really want to involve our regional partners and act as a convener or be a good participant in those discussions.
Okay.
So that's the first big change, but the rest of them, again, they're already things we're working on, and what we need to figure out is how do we accelerate the work we're doing.
All right. Again, the topics today, sustainable tourism and local economic development. And we did see a lot of, from the visioning process, concern over what sustainable tourism looks like, with many people thinking that we've gone too far at this point.
The tourism's gone too far, or over-tourism, as the term has been coined. Yeah, there's a ton of concern in our community. We feel like it's out of balance right now, that it's supporting the tourists more than the residents. And sustainable tourism is a concept that's emerging. You're seeing it in a lot of communities that have been hit hard by this. And the idea is, how do you create a harmony between quality of life for the residents and quality of experience for the tourists? And you've seen council being more aggressive how we protect residential neighborhoods. We've been more choosy about what events we're bringing to town, and we're looking for other ways that we can invest in our infrastructure to support our residents while still not killing our tourism economy, which is essential here. We think the concept of sustainable tourism is a great framework for us to have that conversation with the community, and we're actually planning on bringing Future IQ back to have one more forum to talk about specifically sustainable tourism and what that would look like in our community and what actions may apply.
Yeah, and I guess when I saw kind of the numbers from the visioning evening, where the majority, like 80% or something, feeling like tourism is essential to our community. Mm-hmm. Now when we start talking about local economic development, we know that maybe tourism isn't the only economy that this town has.
It isn't the only economy, but it really accounts for most of our revenues right now. And I don't see that changing radically in the near future. I think we want to expand our offerings in the community. And we've heard arts and culture is an area where the community would like to see us expand upon that. We're going to have to figure out a way to add without removing tourism. In terms of, I think even if climate change becomes an issue and our winter season shortens, people are still going to want to come here. The cities aren't going to get less crowded. The world isn't going to get much cooler. It's still going to be a beautiful place to go to get temperate conditions and less people. But we have to figure out what we want to be as we evolve. And so arts and culture is one area. We're talking about doing more with local foods. We're talking about doing more with the outdoor and snow sports industry. Certainly there are opportunities in film and high altitude training. But really, right now, I think our immediate focus is going to be how we can better balance tourism as we slowly expand other offerings.
Okay. I just wanted to talk briefly about the visioning process Tuesday. Of the nearly 1,000 survey takers, about 80% white, 12% Latino, most between the ages of 40 and 60. Is that representative of our community?
I think that in some ways it probably is representative of our actual demographics. I don't think it's representative of how inclusive we want to be. We have tried very hard to involve as many people as possible in this entire process. I think we figured out we've had about 1,500 people participate through our stakeholder groups, our think tanks, our two summits, and all the surveys. We had translation services at the last one, and unfortunately, they weren't used. I mean, there are elements, our Latinx side of the community has not been very active in this. We've had some focus groups in areas where we've gotten input, but not as active as we'd like to see. We probably haven't had as much youth participation as we'd like to see. We probably haven't had as many seniors there as we'd like to see. So we will continue to reach out to those groups, but we're a little bit befuddled in how we get more participation. We've moved the times around. We've tried to make it as accessible as possible. At the end of the day, people have to want to participate. And if they don't, it's left to us to figure out how do we best represent them. And I would rather hear that from them than be guessing.
And then some of the results that we saw from the live polling at Tuesday's forum showed the people there most willing to spend more money, more property taxes to build affordable housing, more money on transportation. And yet we've committed to what, $40 million for affordable housing? I mean, how much? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out who are these people that have more money to spend on more of this.
That answer really surprised me, Leslie. I actually asked them to insert that because the question is, would you be okay with housing in your neighborhood? And I figured most people would say yes. It's the politically correct thing to do. And I believe that's how many of our people in our community feel. But when it comes down to people opening up their wallet, there's generally more resistance. Turns out we got a lot of support that residents, it's important enough to them that they're willing to spend money on it. Now, certainly that doesn't doesn't mean we're going to go out and start spending money without a lot more community feedback. But we probably are going to have a conversation that if we were to build more housing quicker, it will take more money. And we can go to the community and say, okay, you told us you want us to explore this. This is what it looks like. This is what it would actually cost. This would be the mechanism, and see if the enthusiasm's still there. But at first take, I was really impressed how many people wanted to were willing to invest in their values here, which kind of makes sense. I mean, we all move here for the quality of life, and we pay a premium for that quality of life. So us wanting to sustain it, it does make some sense.
Okay. I've got to leave it there, Andy. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:42. Well, the Stoudemire Planning Commission got another look at the proposed expansion plans for Mountain Life Church at Silver Creek. On the phone to tell us what's next, I have the chair of the Planning Commission, Melina Stevens. Good morning.
Good morning.
Quickly, the church, what was your reaction to that big supportive crowd there Tuesday night?
You know, with the big supportive crowd, it's always really encouraging when a lot of people are involved in the process. I think we get better outcomes, and it was predominantly supportive people, but there were several people that had some constructive criticism and feedback regarding the project, and that was also helpful, I think, in making the project a little bit better in some ways.
You had said that before the next meeting, the Planning Commission wanted to get some more details on a couple of areas. Construction mitigation, what would you like to see there?
One of the neighbors had made a list of some of the issues that they've had just in the past with some construction projects or things that they thought might be issues within, you know, the immediate neighbors. And so for mitigation, they wanted something that would keep the streets a little bit cleaner so it wasn't as muddy, that they could mitigate some of the dust and particles in the air, because that was a significant concern. So those were kind of the basic as far as construction mitigations, mm-hmm. and that's something we asked staff to work with the applicant on to determine what they could reasonably do for that and some of the other issues that were brought up.
Yeah, lighting was another one. I mean, what would you like to see there?
We discussed with lighting that we want to make sure and be careful with this project in particular, because with these entitlements, they run with the land. And so we want to make sure that whatever is entitled as far as lighting is restrictive enough that it doesn't allow whoever owns the property next to be able to have the lights on all the time. So with that, staff is crafting a condition that allows the church to be able to use the light when it's needed and reasonable without it potentially being something in the future if the church expands or changes locations and there's a new owner that they wouldn't be able to do more than we currently expect. We want to make sure, especially with lighting, that we're being careful on that.
And one of the other issues was the amount of paving. A couple of colleagues said that it goes against county policy to have such big expanses of asphalt, but, I mean, what can you do?
Within the county and with some of our more recent projects, we've really been trying to decrease the amount of asphalt. We want to make sure that we're not just having expansive parking lots, because for a while that was more of what was put in place, were just large parking lots. With this project, it's challenging because of the nature of the site, because of the wetlands, to be able to do much else. And the church brought up several good points that right now it's both a safety issue for the members because they're parking wherever they can. They're also they're using a shuttle to get members there as well, which they will continue to do. But for what they need, they need more parking.
Yeah.
So I think that we will get to a place with this project where it will be a benefit to them and to the community, because they do a lot for the community.
All right. And then quickly, the amendments for a lot at the Silver Creek Village Center, a parcel there where applicants are asking for a modified grade, a height increase to a maximum of 45 feet, and a building that can be 2/3 affordable housing. So it sounds like we returned to the recurring debate between the Planning Commission and Mountainlands Community Housing Trust about integrating affordable units into the into the development. Do you think these amendments would result in a bunch of apartments isolated on the edge of the village center?
We want to make sure with this project, because it's a critical project, if for no other reason than because there are so many pieces of this project, so many houses and businesses that are involved, that we're doing as good of a job as we can to make sure that we're being true to the development agreement, as well as just producing a good end product for the community. So with this, we asked the applicant to come back with a more holistic view of the project. We were looking really specifically at one parcel and what they wanted to do there and the height exception and discussing buildings without seeing sketches or plans or really having a clear understanding of what they wanted to put there, what it would ultimately look like. So we expect next time for them to come with some sketches, with some maps showing where the current affordable housing that has been approved is, where they're anticipating this to be as far as how many units and where the rest of the units will be throughout the remainder of the project. What we don't want to see is that they fulfill their entire obligation with condos and apartment units, and that we don't have townhouses and single family homes that are also affordable integrated within the entire project.
Okay. So, anything else you wanted to mention, Melina?
Just that we appreciate staff and appreciate the public. It was really helpful to have everyone participate last meeting, and encourage people to continue as we have some pretty significant projects that we're working on currently.
Okay, Melina, appreciate your time this morning. This week, the owners of the 10 acres there at the base of Park City Mountain Resort submitted their development application with the Park City Planning Department. In the studio with a preview of what that application looks like, I have Robert Schmidt. He is the Chief Development Officer with PEG Development, the owners of the property. Good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Leslie. Nice to see you again.
So I was kind of asked not to promote this interview. I think a lot of people have a lot of interest in this. We've been talking about it for years. But what was the secret behind this?
Well, we just wanted to have the opportunity to let folks know in our own voice that we're here. We've made the application to the city. It's in. Really this signifies for us a kickoff of a much broader community discussion, and getting feedback from the community and from the city, and so we're looking forward to that.
Okay. So the press release that was issued with this says that details the proposed development that we'll get into in a little bit here. It says that you've spent a year with community outreach, city staff meetings. Tell me what some of that community outreach looked like, and were these folks required to sign some non-disclosure agreements? And the reason I ask is because I have heard nothing about this. I know a lot of people in town, so I'm like, who did you talk to?
Well, we had several meetings with folks that are really closely related to the resort, so neighbors and HOAs that are right around the resort that might be more directly impacted by what this project would be, and some folks in the community leaders, and we hosted those meetings with the intent to give folks an opportunity to see what we are proposing, give us some feedback early on, allow us to address some of those concerns. And nobody signed any non-disclosure agreements. We did ask that they not share any site plans or information. But other than that, very productive meetings. We were very pleased with the feedback that we received.
Okay, let's take a step back and let me have you tell us just a little bit of the history here. I mean, these were properties owned by Vail Resorts, which were then sold to PEG Development, and PEG Development is based here in Utah?
Yeah, PEG Development's based in Provo. And let me clarify just a little bit. We are under contract with Vail, so we will be purchasing those properties once we've received the approvals from the city. So we have a contract with Vail. That's the nature of the relationship. But we will be the owner and the developer of the project.
Okay, and it's we're talking about three parking lots, is that?
That's correct. There are three parking lots. They're technically divided into four parcels right now, but the upper lot and then the two lower lots.
Okay, so let's talk about the development, at least as the application shows. Does it meet code? I mean, are there going to be future discussions about this is too big, there's not enough parking, there's too many units? all of that. I mean, it does it meet code as submitted?
We feel that it does. Yeah. You know, we've got an existing development agreement that provides for an amount of density units, an amount of square footage. We are between 15 and 20% under what's allowed in the development agreement. Additionally, there's height that's discussed in the development agreement master plan. We're meeting those standards. We're meeting the standards of open space. We're meeting the standards of parking. And so while we certainly expect lots of discussion around all of that, we feel that we've submitted an application that is harmonious with the community, with the environment, less than what's allowed in the development agreement, and you know, hoping that that's a positive thing for everybody involved.
Okay. So does it come under a master plan development?
It does.
Application?
It does,
mm-hmm.
Yes. It's a master plan under the development agreement.
And then what does that require? I mean, because sometimes the open space numbers are huge, you know, like 60% or something.
Yes, much of the open space was set aside in the original development agreement. So much of what's on the mountain today is part of the open space that was set aside.
Okay. So let's talk about, you've got condominiums, affordable, employee housing, a hotel. How many for-sale condos are we talking about?
There's about 150, 155 for-sale condos.
And those are going to be positioned where?
So they're kind of spread out through the project. So there are some that are on the upper lot, and then there are some that are on the two lower lots as well. So they're spread around a little bit, and then on the lower lot, right at the base of the hill, there's also a hotel. A four-star hotel that will be placed there as well.
So is that going to be just north of the Shadow Ridge, the hotel, or up further?
That will...
By first time?
Just north of Shadow Ridge, yes, by first time.
Oh, okay. But that would kind of be northwest.
Yes, yeah. Technically.
Yeah, because we got that lower parking lot just north of Shadow Ridge.
Yeah, so...
That's the hotel we're talking about?
So if you are familiar with the area, right there at first time is the parking lot.
The first-time parking lot,
let's call it that.
Yeah.
That's where the hotel will be located, in that parking lot, along with condominiums and a very nice ski beach and ski plaza and amenities there that will really, we hope, bring a lot of vitality to that area.
Yeah, and kind of that's where they've got their beginner skiing as well. It'll open some of that up there for them as well then?
Correct, yes.
Yeah. Okay, and then in terms of the press release saying 70,000 square feet, which I think it sounds like it's lumping affordable and employee housing together. Are we talking about just one building or?
So the affordable housing is, what we've done is we've provided a significant amount of affordable housing. It's in compliance with the city guidelines. And we have it all in the first phase of the project. So it will be on the upper lot, what we call parcel B, but it's the upper lot on the south side of the property. And it will be all inclusive in phase one. So we're going to do all the affordable housing up front.
Okay. So again, are we talking one building?
For the affordable housing?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, one building for the affordable housing.
Okay. And then is there a separate building then for the employee housing? Or is that?
Well, affordable and employee housing is combined. So all the employee and affordable housing is in one building.
Okay. So the affordable housing won't be for sale then? It'll be rentals?
There will be some for sale affordable housing.
Be.
Yes.
And what are we talking about? Small condos, townhomes?
Yes, condos, yes.
Ah, okay. And so that requires, I think the city code requires, what, 20% of the development needs to be?
15%.
15%? So yes. How many units then are we talking about?
Oh, you're going to, it's all in the application. The details are in there. And I don't recall off the top of my head exactly the number of for sale condos there.
Okay. And then the retail and restaurants, where does that going to get developed?
Yeah, so that's on the phase two and phase three, which is in the first time lot, we'll call it that. We have, you know, a very nice plaza designed. It continues all the way down to the intersection of Empire and Silver King, the plaza does. And then fronting the plaza is retail. And we'll say skier services, restaurants, you know, types of things that are important to a ski resort and servicing the guests at the ski resort. So,
all right. Now, all of this gets built on then underground parking. Is that the plan?
It's underground parking, or it's parking that's wrapped with housing. So there are portions that are above ground, but you would never see them because they are wrapped by the housing. So,
okay. And so, just there is day skier parking, but it will all be paid because it's underground. At this
there
point.
Is day skier parking. Yeah, we're replacing The surface lot, all the stalls that are on the surface lot will be replaced in structured parking. And, yeah, so.
Do you mean structured above ground then? Or
both.
Oh, both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it will all be in a parking structure.
All right. Park City Municipal had a memorandum of understanding with the former owners, Powder Corp, to do some kind of transit hub there in that upper parking lot. Is that still part of these plans?
You know, we're contemplating improving that transit hub significantly, and we've proposed some ideas, and we'll be working with the city to refine those as we go through this process, and working with the landowner there as well. That transit hub sits on property that's not owned by us or the city, and so there are other parties that will be involved, and we've been talking to them as well, and we think there's positive things that can occur there.
Yeah. I know that public ski lockers for both day and season use was probably a big thing that you heard from folks. That we'll ride the bus if there's a place to keep our ski equipment.
It absolutely was one of the biggest things that we heard was we need lockers. And so we took that back and incorporated that specifically into our plans to provide that. It's funny, we heard stories of people that would park their cars there to use them as their day skier locker while they transited back and forth shuttling kids and skiers and so we heard that loud and clear.
And so where were those going to be?
We'll have a couple of different locations in both the upper and the lower lots. Both parts of that development will have day skier lockers. So they'll be very convenient for both bus and skiers that are arriving via car.
And so circulation's going to change, and I know that it's probably difficult to explain, but I mean, are we going to see some of that interior roads go away and then kind of just make it, it's all going to be one way, kind of looping around?
Yeah, it is hard to discuss or hard to explain, and it's all in the application, and certainly the details will be coming out and people can take a look at that. But what we're proposing is revamping the traffic system to a one-way circulation loop. And we would put a couple of roundabouts in at the north end of the project at the intersection of Empire and Silver King and Lowell and Silver King. And then what it will do is have drivers come in. As they come in off of 224, they'll circulate counterclockwise up onto Lowell. And then it would be two lanes, one way, circulating around Lowell back onto Empire. And so that's our proposal right now. Again, lots of discussions as folks weigh in and we get feedback from the city and the community on that idea.
So when does the public get a look at this? I know that you're hoping to schedule some open houses. Is that prior to the public meeting at the Planning Commission level?
We will have several open houses and meetings with the community over the next few weeks. We'll be announcing dates and times, but we will be holding those before we go to the Planning Commission for sure.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention in the last 10 seconds I got?
No, we're excited to be here, excited to have this application in, and look forward to lots of great discussions over the next few weeks and months.
Okay, Robert, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.